The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. This week, Griffin Barber interviews Brian Trent about his first Bain novel, Perdition's Storm. Set in John Ringo's Black Tide Rising universe and released at the beginning of the month, Perdition's Storm takes us to Italy and resolves a major question in that universe. And later, we continue with part 37 of One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name.
Hi there, I'm Griffin Barber, your host for today's edition of the Bain Free Radio Hour. Brian Trent is here with us today to talk about his debut Bain novel, Perdition's Storm, an exciting addition to the Black Tide Rising universe. Hello and welcome, Brian.
Hello, nice to be here, Griffin.
So, hardest question first. I like to lead off with the simple ones. What is the coolest aspect of Perdition's Storm for you?
I mean, I love the opportunity to contribute to this extremely popular universe. So, I was invited, this goes back a few years now, but I received an invitation to write a short story set in the universe, with the directive being it was going to be set a year after the events of the mainline novels. So I had already published in it with a number of other Bain anthologies. It was in back-to-back issues of the Year's Best Military and Adventure Sci-Fi. And I was in Cosmic Corsairs and World's Long Lost. So what I feel very strongly, whenever you do a sequel or a prequel or a spinoff of any kind, there's two rules you have to abide by. The first is you have to respect the source material.
Yeah.
Right. That's something that Hollywood can't wrap its collective mind around. The second rule is you want to meaningfully expand the universe of the original. So my go-to example for a great sequel is 1986's James Cameron film Aliens, right? I mean, it builds so meaningfully on Ridley Scott's 1979 original. Right. It respects the source material, but then it gives you a little more detail about the xenomorph life cycle. It gives you more about what's the development on that planet and Ellen Ripley's character arc. So it's just, to me, it's like the textbook great sequel. So when I wanted to write in the Black Tide Rising universe, I was looking for opportunities to expand, to tell something that hadn't been done. And Europe, specifically Italy, where my novel takes place, isn't really examined in depth. In fact, you don't see a lot of apocalyptic fiction in Italy anyway, which is ironic given the fact that it's the site of the collapse of the Roman Empire and right. It's had plagues and barbarian invasions. So, I mean, writing that setting itself, I think, was one of the most, first of all, contributing to the universe, right? And then I was invited a year later to write another short story, and after that, to write the full novel. But then having Italy as a setting was probably, is the silver medalist. So.
Very cool. So it's clear you didn't really stumble on that. So you worked your way towards it instead. So I guess you've already kind of covered my next question, which is how you came to write in the universe. But how was the experience? I mean, how did you enjoy the short stories? Obviously, it was pretty cool to do that. And then that you were willing to do the novel.
It was a wonderful experience. So the first story I wrote when I decided to settle in Italy, I mean, I introduced this character as a former contract killer for the Italian mafia. But he's trying to walk the straight and narrow now, whatever that means in the apocalypse, right?
Right.
So he's trying to help rebuild society, trying to get people back on their feet and work with different communities. And he encounters an antagonist, and so it becomes this dark adventure. And then when I was asked, and every time I write a story, I always put a lot of world building seeds into it, just to add a little more detail to the world, little things that are happening on the margin. We're shining a spotlight here, but there's other things happening in the
universe. For the readers, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when they asked me to do another story set in the universe, another short story, I harvested some of those seeds. I had mentioned things happening in Venice, and I decided to set the second story in Venice so we can actually see what's happening. And little things about the main character, Silvio Cipriano, he has had some tragedy in his life. And with the second story, I answered who was responsible for that tragedy. But so when they asked me to do a full novel, I saw this as an opportunity to really blow out the characters and really get into the setting. A setting is, to me, that's the chief muse, right? Is where is your, because everything else stems from the setting. So I really got into the, boots on the ground in Italy. And so I think that was that journey into writing more and more in the Black Tide Reading Universe has been wonderful. And I ran the story idea by John Ringo for the novel, and he gave me the green light, which, you know, I'm very grateful for. So thanks, John.
You're talking about Cipriano, your main character, but which character in Perdition Storm kind of surprised you when you were writing it?
So without question, the character that surprised me the most was a character named Giuseppe Gambino. Giuseppe, I introduced in the very first story, and he was kind of a frenemy, a little rivalry there. But in the novel, and I should say that readers don't have to have read, you don't have to be familiar with the first two stories. I'm going to be helpful, but I feel very strong that every story should stand on its own.
Right.
I've written sequels to, you know, my own stories, and I want them to stand on their own, right? So he's briefly mentioned in the first two stories, but this one in Perdition Storm, he surprised me. He became a very fascinating character. He's got a very natural arc that we all can understand. He's definitely more in the antagonist role, but it's antagonists that you can sympathize with are I think the most interesting. There are people throughout history who've just been bad for the sake of being bad, but the more interesting ones are the villains that you're like, okay, I see where he started breaking bad, right? I see where he started going awry. And I had a blast writing him, and his arc is very tragic. So I have to say, unquestionably, Giuseppe Gambino.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And they came to be because did you know anything about him, or did you just kind of use a real person that you had kind of developed from, or?
I mean, I don't think I developed any of the characters based on specific people, but like in the first story, I wanted to introduce a colorful collection of people. These are the survivors of the apocalypse. That alone puts them in a special club. Right. And then I wanted to also have them kind of bounce off each other with conflicting personalities, right? So, and Perdition Storm is very much about that. You've got you got Silvio Cipriani as your main character, former hitman trying to build a life for the people he cares for. And then you have Giuseppe, you have, and then of course, the main character is Silvio's daughter, who is being, he's trying to raise her responsibly. What does that mean in the apocalypse, right? What does that mean when you have a very different set of needs? And there's also a family lineage that comes into play, because Silvio's father was, just a monster. Just a really, really bad dude. And so Sylvia wants to raise his daughter so she can survive in this new world, but he also doesn't want her to become, you know, the demon that he grew up with. Right. So I like, it makes for an interesting story of family dynamics and sins of the father and how to, what do
and
you
it's
do?
True to the, it's true to the original books too, because John's got lots of family stories. The ones that Mike Massa wrote, you know, it's the other half of that equation. So yeah, very much true to the universe to have that family situation and trying to do what's best for your kids in a horrible situation and still worrying about the result, even though you're doing your damnedest to make sure that they don't have it as rough as they might have it otherwise. So yeah, I dug that aspect.
Right. Excellent. I'm glad. Well, yeah, because you're like, okay, you want to imbue your children in this very difficult, hard life now with the survival skills, but you also don't want to end up with Jack the Ripper. Right. So that was actually a very enjoyable aspect of writing it too, because it's a completely different set of morality and needs and resources and people and cultures, right? So yeah.
So going away from the characters for a little bit, but Perdition Storm deals with some of the great places that are entirely steeped in history.
Nice.
Did you have any trepidation in writing these places into Perdition Storm, or was it just pure fun?
It was pure fun, because I've been to Italy. Italy's one of my favorite places in the world. I love the food. I love the people. I grew up in a largely Italian household, and the history. And there's just so much. And the book is packed with just. I'm having fun by getting into some of the details. Like, for example, you know, in an apocalypse without firefighters, with buildings, modern buildings being made of highly flammable materials, that we count on sprinkler systems to work. And what happens if we don't have the sprinkler systems, right? Well, ancient buildings, ancient Roman building techniques are going to outlast what we build because, first of all, I mean, they're just sturdier being of concrete, Roman concrete and stone and so forth. But the other thing is, in researching, they found this a few years ago. They discovered this through some tests, but ancient Roman concrete is self-healing. It's because it's not as refined as what we do now. So when ancient Roman concrete cracks and water gets into the cracks, it there's little nuggets, these little lime caps they're called, and they expand and they fill in the crack and when they harden stronger than ever. So the Colosseum is stronger today than it was when it was built 2,000 years ago. Yeah. Today, our concrete cracks, it stays cracked until someone comes along and fix it. You know, and if it doesn't, the bridge is coming down. So little things like that. So I've been, I've been all throughout Italy, and this is one of my favorite places to go. Venice is a major location, and I get into the history and the geography of it. I get into, of course, because this is a little dealing with the Italian mafia, of course we go to Sicily, and Palermo and Ravenna and Rome itself. So, I have had a chance to walk in the locations, so I hope that brings, some credibility and verisimilitude to the world.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. Venice, especially the lagoon and that sequence there, that's certainly grabbed my attention, having been there myself. So yeah, I really did it. I did enjoy that aspect of it.
Thanks.
Was there some trepidation about the series generally, just writing in the series? Was it?
Yeah. That there was a little bit, of course, because again, I want to be respectful. I mean, whatever, as I mentioned about respecting the source material, you know, I've been invited to play in the universe, and you know, unlike certain film studios, and this is a world people care about, and I care about, and I wanted to offer something. I wanted to play well, but I also wanted to offer something a little different, right? Something in the scene, something on the periphery that we haven't seen, but it works. And there is crossover there, and there are references to things that are happening behind the scenes, which I think is how you got to do a sequel, right? Because otherwise, if you don't offer something new, then you're just doing a retread.
Yeah.
So it's striking that balance. And a couple of the revelations that the book will introduces to the series. Again, I ran it by John and he was cool with it. I do hope people like it. It was a lot of fun to write it. I'm really looking forward to sharing it with everybody. Yeah, so
for sure. Speaking of which, I really like the writers.
The female writers.
Who seem absolutely flipping nuts. Without going too deep into spoiler land, what inspired those characters or that group?
So yeah, I want to be careful what I say here because I don't want to, but yes, there is. So with the collapse of society, you got to figure that some people are going to dig their heels in and figure out how to survive and be rational about it. And some people are going to go more the Don Quixote, like, you know, fantasy world where there are no rules. And when there are no rules, and you're kind of in your own little silo, which is the Pale Riders. The Pale Riders, I'll say this for listeners, the Pale Riders are a evolution or devolution, depending on your perspective, of the famous horse riders in Siena, right? So without competitions now.
To unpack that a little bit, is absolutely bonkers. I mean, they're riding today during the annual, or is it annual? I think it's annual. The races in Siena. I mean, if you ever watch that, there's plenty of YouTube videos. It's the running of the bulls on the backs of the horses. Like it is crazy.
These people, they're extraordinarily skilled and they're absolutely out of their minds. Yeah. And so I just, when I was looking at asking myself, well, how, extrapolating from modern Italy, what would happen in these different cities, the different cultures, what happened. And I was reading about the riders in Siena, and I'm like, what would they do? I mean, they're accomplished equestrians, right? They're absolutely fearless, right? And they've got these trained steeds, and now they're not competing against each other. They're going to work together because this is their culture. What do they do? So they go a little, they lose all perspective, right? But they're good at what they do. It's just they definitely are the oddballs in post-apocalyptic Italy. I did have fun writing them too, writing the writers. So yeah.
So in a similar vein, which character from Perdition Storms would you want to avoid, like the plague, and why?
Okay. Well, I would have to say any of the main there's three main villains in the book. All of them would best be avoided. They're very different from each other, as you know. So probably the one to avoid the most would probably be Jacob York. He's kind of the barbarian in Kevlar. He's probably the most dangerous, and absolutely the they're all sociopathic in their own way. Although, like they believe what they're doing is correct. They believe that they're the heroes of their story, but that is not a kind of person you want to cross. Which, of course, sets him up as a great antagonist to the to the main characters, to the heroes. So, yeah.
So, which character would you want as an ally?
Well, I've got to, I mean, it just sounds like a cheat, but it's got to be Silvio Soprano, because his skills that he honed earlier in life, when push comes to shove, he's still an extraordinarily deadly and efficient individual. Even though he doesn't want to be doing that stuff, he's the reluctant hero. He's he and his this he feels the sins of his past are catching up with him. Him and of course, his partner, Anna. She is also extraordinarily resourceful, very knowledgeable. She should be a tour director. So she had some interesting ideas of how to survive. When I was in Italy, I went up to the caves in Orvieto, and there's people have been living in those caves way before even the Etruscans, right? You have old Villanovan cultures, and they had this terrific idea back when there weren't a lot of resources, almost like a pre. It kind of is a parallel to an apocalypse in a way. It's the opposite of the spectrum, but like a horseshoe, they're close, right? So they're trying to have a steady source of protein. So what do they do is they carve these little niches in the walls of their caves, and they raise pigeons for their meat, and the pigeons would come in to be fed, and they just had this steady supply. So what Anna does in the book, this is told very early on in flashback, but she's like, that's what I'm going to do. She's been giving this lecture about this in the past, so that's what we're going to do again. We're going to rediscover the habits of our ancestors from 3,000 years ago, because they knew what they were doing, because they had to, and we have to now. So this nice. I think the two of them together make a nice pair.
My favorite's Mateo. I just got to say,
Okay, no, fair enough. I mean, yeah.
the
Thank you
skilled
for.
old man who does not give two shits. It's a lot of fun that way too. But
Matteo's
yeah,
the
so
for the
and
read
that.
for listeners. He's the former member of the Italian Armed Forces, and is very proficient at what he does, and is crack shot, and is just kind of the old lion, who has seen it all and is just wants to retire. But man, he's got to dust off his weapons and his skill set and everything else, and do what's necessary. So.
Yeah, so you're given a good gallery of heroes for us to follow and root for in the series in the book. So really enjoyed that aspect of it as
Thank
well.
you. Thanks, Griffin.
So you're talking about the Oviedo not ruins but cave system that they developed into residences. They depend the events of Perdition Storm depend heavily on the geography of the area. I had the sense that you walked a lot of the ground in Italy, so could you have any recommendations specifically on where to go and what to see?
Yeah, first of all, I would recommend going to Italy. Absolutely. It not only is it a great country, but because of its geography and its history, it's almost like visiting a dozen mini countries. I mean, Venice is so different from Ravenna, which is so different from Rome, which is so different from the Lake Como area, which is so different from Sicily and the Amalfi Coast and Naples. And they still had that medieval city-state quality. Which is there. So I would say, I mean, Venice, it's a cheat, but Venice is, it's like a movie set. It's so surreal. And I've seen other cities in Europe with canals. There's nothing like Venice. And it's built in a swamp, right? It was built, it's such a defiance. It's built in a swamp and it's sinking slowly. So it's going to be tomorrow's Atlantis. So it's just a very cool place. And, of course, Rome, just for the ruins alone, for where the Forum is and to see the Colosseum is terrific. What else could I say? I mean, in southern Italy, I would say you want to see, Florence is another one too. And I didn't get a chance to visit Florence in Perdition Storm. I had to, keep it to a few places, but there's so you can't turn around and not find great food and really interesting people. And you drop a shovel and you're hitting
history. Yeah, for sure. Not even necessarily ancient, because you know, early modern period, they're so important at so many eras. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the popes, you know, the Middle Ages, there's no time that they're more important. And then they're kind of shunted to the side by the Holy Roman Empire and the Germans coming down and eventually the Spanish and the different popes. So, yeah, there's some really amazing stuff in there that is it is neat. Most of Europe is kind of that way.
Yeah.
In particular, Italy has been interesting because of the patterns of conquest, et cetera. I mean, some of the Sicilian places were Greek colonies, right?
Right. Oh, all of southern Italy was Greek colonies. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And they didn't care for the Romans very much. These upstarts from this little insignificant city up north. Yeah. And then, of course, to piggyback on what you just said, I mean, look at, and then in the 20th century, you have, you know, Benito Mussolini and where Italy went there. And so, and I try to cover a lot of that because it's not only is Perdition, Storm, and Adventure, and not only is it about, you know, the infected and about these antagonists and all that, but it's also, it is a tour of the rich layers of history in Italy, because you can't go anywhere without encountering that.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was quite enjoyable. And I'm not hearing many specific ones, just Italy in general. Just go to Italy.
I would say if I had to single something out, though, I would say absolutely go to Venice. Absolutely go to Rome. Actually, Siena itself, I mean, home of the Pale Riders. It is a beautiful city, a stone metropolis. And also I would say Assisi also. Assisi is a beautiful, beautiful medieval style city.
Right.
Where I still have a funny memory there. I went into a wine shop and I walk in and I've never been fed in a wine store, liquor store in America. But there I get, you know, they broke out crispy bread. They broke out black truffles. They broke out, opened up a bunch of bottles of wine. And of course I spent a whole bunch there because it's like, I'm being treated. They were just, and I
got the family
turntables. Just like, oh, you're here. Let's have a nice moment together. Right. See, that's the other thing great about Italy too. It is a welcoming, it's a welcoming culture or style there. So,
and fashion. I mean, they pretty much do everything.
Yeah.
The one place I want to go that I haven't yet is the Beretta factory and museum.
Oh, I haven't been there either.
That's the oldest existing family owned business in the world.
Wow. Okay.
So I think they've gone from like the 13th century or 14th century. They literally have been family owned for the better part of a millennia, which is insane.
There's so much. That's the thing. There's so much history wherever you go. I mean, you can have that. You can walk into a restaurant that's been there for 600 years, right?
Yeah. So it's either it's Beretta, and then they have Franchi is the name of the other shotguns that they have. And they have their own hydroelectric dam up there that Mussolini built for them to make sure that they were still being able to produce guns when during the Spanish Civil War, I believe, is when he started it.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, you can, that's the other thing too. You can visit Italy 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. You're going to go somewhere new. You're going to find something now.
Yeah. Scratch the surface and
figure
out what you want to go and check out again the next time. And then there's the sports, football, motorsport, motorcycles, Ferraris.
We got a little bit into that during the writing of it. Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. I won't say too much about that, but I think I try to touch on a lot of stuff. It's definitely I do hope readers will enjoy where the story goes and what happens.
I'm sure they will. I certainly did. Okay. So I see you have a podcast of your own.
You
got to tell us a little bit about what goes on there and who you're aimed at for.
Yeah. So I'm an old school science fiction aficionado. I mean, I grew up on Forbidden Planet and them and The Day of the Earth Stood Still and, you know, all the old classics in film. And then, of course, in literature, I mean, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury, even H.P. Lovecraft, who wrote more science fiction than most people realize. So my podcast is called Space Station Squid. And it each episode just deals with a different topic in science. Sometimes I'll talk about a certain movie and how it relates to the genre at large. Sometimes I'll talk about a certain concept whether it's time travel or AI or anything. So it's and they're short. I like to keep it short and sweet, about a half hour episodes. It's just I enjoy really delving into this genre. So many people who don't know talk about history. So many people don't know about the history of the genre itself. So there's just an opportunity for a quick exploration of, for example, I just did an episode comparing 1979's The Black Hole with 1997's Event Horizon, right? Because I'm just castling the digits, 79, 97, and they both happen to deal with a very similar subject, surprisingly similar, even though one's not supposed to be a remake of the other. So little things like that, and what that means.
And one's labeled as horror, and one's labeled as adventure, and one's a kid's movie, and the other one is definitely not.
And then you have like science fiction, which is with little dollops of horror, and then you got like a horror film with some trappings of science fiction, right? Or I did Dreamscape. I've covered Forbidden Planet and how Forbidden Planet is arguably the most important science fiction movie ever made, because it's more in our age of social media, with all of our monsters of the id unleashed, it's particularly relevant. So there's lines on that I'm like, man, they could be talking about the latest outrage online, right? So I have a lot of fun with it, and I if anybody's interested in science fiction and fantasy at all, feel free to check it out. You can find it on Spotify, you can find it on my own website, briantrent.com, and it's something I really enjoy talking about. So
I was thinking about that when you were talking about Alien and aliens, because the one thing to this day, Aliens is the best military science fiction film ever done.
It's best, one of the best action movies ever made, one of the best military science fiction, one of the best.
It is the best. I'm not brooking any argument.
I can't think of a better one. I'd be totally agree. I actually have an episode on my podcast about how to make sequels and prequels, right? And I do cite that one among some other ones.
That's for sure. It's an interesting thing again, and it ticks all those boxes you were talking about. Like it adds to the universe. It presents a new facet to it. You didn't even talk about the Colonial Marines are being introduced, all that kind of stuff that hasn't been done. And it's interesting in light of the television show. I don't know if you've watched that or not on Hulu.
I saw the first episode, it certainly was going for the aesthetic, so I'll give them that. I haven't seen enough to be able to judge it beyond that. I am extraordinarily against sequels and prequels as a general rule, because they just mess up so many times that I can think of a handful. I can think of a small handful of remakes that I think are actually good, and a small group of sequels and prequels that are good. But it's a select club, I think.
For sure. Yeah. they do an excellent job in I think it's the fourth episode.
Okay.
Of basically recreating what actually, a complete alien Nostromo type horror show.
Okay. All right.
It is worthwhile, because you also don't know what the flip is going on. They did a really good job of restoring the mystery that was lost with Prometheus, that piece of garbage.
Yeah, I don't. Yes. I like to say that there's only two Alien films, and Prometheus was just a collective bad dream that we all had. So, makes it particularly perplexing, since Ridley Scott was behind that one. So I'm not exactly sure what happened there. Yeah. But we'll chalk it up to a fugue state.
Yep. For sure. So we're getting on to the last little bit here. But what, aside from its raw entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them long after reading Perdition Storm?
Well, I certainly hope that they enjoy the journey of the characters. Because every single character has a journey. They all have arcs that are plotted out. And I think that they've enjoyed the Black Tide Rising series so far, and this just moves the camera a little bit to the peninsula of Italy, and here's what's going on there. And there are little crossovers for people who know the story. They're going to see the references. They're going to see things that by radio and repeaters, that rumors. That's the other thing too. Stories and legends are spreading like in olden days. And some of those legends are coming from what's happening in America in the mainline books. Yeah. And then of course, Italy has its own, and other countries have their own. So
the Pale Riders are a great example. They're going to be legend.
They're going to be led. Yeah, they're going to be, people 2,000 years from now will be referring to these quasi-mythical lunatics. So I hope they enjoy the adventure. If people enjoy it as much as I enjoyed writing it, then I'm happy. This is an area of the apocalypse just beyond the press series proper that we don't usually see. How many times do you see the apocalypse in Europe, or specifically Italy? That's what I hope people get out of it. Yeah.
Very cool. So our last question today, unless you've got something else you wanted to make sure that you touch upon that we haven't talked about.
I would only say that if people do enjoy Perdition Storm, you feel free to check. I write military science fiction. Red Space Rising is my hard futuristic military sci-fi novel, so feel free to check that out in its prequel, 10,000 Thunders, is all I would say. So other than that, just
I dig your titles.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Those titles are really cool. I haven't had a chance to read them yet, but I'm looking forward to eventually getting there. So the last question being, what conventions can your fans hope to catch up with you at? And what other work do you have in the pipeline for us or for your fans?
So I would say, I haven't historically gone to a lot of conventions. I love to go to LibertyCon next year if possible. I will be at DragonCon next year for sure.
Cool.
At that point, it's just
have
kind
you
of-
got your hotel room yet?
I'm making arrangements with some friends who are already going there. So
okay, cool.
Because they already have their own booth too. So
all right, because that's the it's the Hunger Games trying to get your room for Dragon.
That's what I've been told. And then beyond that, I've published more than 100 short stories, so we always have short stories coming out. I'm working on an alternate history series right now, and set in the Cold War. So there's a bunch of things in the pipeline.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Appreciate spending some time with you again. I quite enjoyed working with you on this, and I hope you had the same experience with us.
I did very much. It was great work. Great working with you. Great working in this universe. Great working with you. It's been a very positive experience. Bane's just terrific. So.
All right. Well, cool. This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour with Brian Trent discussing Perdition Storm.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makan, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
His body toppled, the flash-cauterized flesh of his neck still sizzling. The smell of his burning flesh followed the visual a second later. I turned away from the corpse, hoping to avoid having the image and the stench etched into my memory. But it was too late. Both would come back to haunt me, probably in the middle of one of those sweat-soaked nights when the dead and the injured chase me through the dark passages of my mind. I shook my head to clear away the self-pity. He'd chosen to fight, and he'd lost. He was dead, and I was alive. "Thank you," I said to Lobo, "for saving my life. And for not making me personally kill him," I thought, but did not say. "You're welcome," he said. "As I warned you earlier, surgical removal is frequently the only reasonable option." "Yes," I said. "Yes, you did." I was hoping to avoid more killing, but it was a stupid hope all along. "You didn't kill," Lobo said. "I did. Does that help?" I considered the question as Lobo sat down and I boarded. He shut the doors behind me and we took off quickly. "No," I said. I'd long ago promised myself that I'd never ignore the consequences of my own actions. I didn't have to like what I did, but I wouldn't ever try to fool myself into believing I hadn't taken an action. "You fired the pulse, but the moment I decided to come back for Osterlad, I killed either him or me. I just didn't realize it at the time. Should I sink the boat? Lobo asked. Do you believe we've left any traces they can link back to us? None beyond the quality of the countermeasures and weapons, Lobo said. Those factors do limit the possibilities to attackers with access to at least fairly current technologies. Osterlad moved in a world where enough of his clients and competitors had such tech that I'd at worst be one option among many. The proximity of his death and John's wasn't in our favor, but working for us was the power vacuum that his death would cause in his company and the corporate turmoil that would ensue as his potential successors scrambled to take over and lock down their empires. I granted myself one bit of peace. As surely as I'd made decisions that had led to his death, Osterlad had too. I had to assume he'd dealt honorably with Slake, or Slake wouldn't have recommended him. If Osterlad had extended me the same respect and working relationship he'd offered Kelko, he'd be alive now. The crew on the ship had no chance to make any of those choices, so killing them would be going too far. Of course, I suppose that even working for Osterlad was in a way making the choice to risk being a pawn in this type of situation. I could spiral down this philosophical hole as long as I could stand it, and I could eventually make it take me anywhere I wanted to go. But the simple truth was that I wasn't willing to kill the boat's crew as they slept off the effects of the Dulzit injections. Leave the boat alone, I said. Okay, Lobo said. Where should I take us now? Chung had offered the bounty, so Chung was my best bet to lift it. Back to the shuttle storage, I said, so I can gather some more information. We need to find a way to meet with Zychek's Mr. Chung. Chapter 12. Where Osterlad's business had reeked of privacy and discretion, Zychek, like Kelko, operated from the eye of a non-stop whirlwind of marketing hype. Advertisements for its products blared from walls, displays, clothing, vehicles, employees, and pretty much anything capable of displaying images or emitting sounds. The ads defined the leading edge of a high-stakes fight for market share. Both companies maintained hundreds of flexi-fabs on Lankin, each facility pumping out product as fast as the markets could absorb it, feeding off the usual mixture of open designs, corporate trade secret data, and, I had to assume, the occasional purloined competitive processes. The self-configuring manufacturing units worked so efficiently that they and their cousins here and on other worlds had wiped out the personal fab craze that had swept a lot of planets a few centuries ago, well before my birth. Die-hard do-it-yourselfers still fed designs into home fabs and pretended their dedicated smaller units created higher quality goods than the stuff the rest of us bought. The simple truth, though, was that the big flexi fabs did the same work enough better and enough faster that the profit from their goods let Zychek and Kelko and other corporate beasts roar their dominion over the jungle of markets not only here, but in every seriously populated region of space. Zychek and Kelko were the only major corporate players on Lankin, and their marketing machines made sure you never forgot that fact. Zychek might have lost the rights to Mackin, but from what I gathered as I walked about town and wandered through publicly available data stores, the company was nonetheless doing extremely well. In fact, as best as I could tell from the public Insta-sales data, Zychek had recently increased its overall planetary share a few tenths of a percentage point. Perhaps Kelko Lankin was suffering a bit from Slake and his team having to focus their attention on Mackin. Jose Chung held the reins of the Zychek Lankin corporate animal, and if the local business gossip commentators were right, his star was on the rise. As publicly visible as Osterlad had been shadowy, Chung made it his job to put a personal face on Zai Check and to represent the company anywhere that doing so might help sales. From facility openings to R&D endowments to corporate reality broadcasts, Chung was everywhere. His smiling face as strong a Zai Check symbol as the logo that adorned everything the company made. Personal data on the man remained scarce. His privacy, no doubt, helped by the standard corporate army of net info cleaners, soft bots that roamed databases seeking and destroying protected corporate info. Few private citizens had the resources to keep the cleaners current enough to make them useful, but for corporate bigwigs, high-class data protection, like skilled bodyguards, came with the job. I roamed Queen's Bar for 3 days, talking with all the globally linked machines not under Zai Check or Kelco control, and I learned absolutely nothing useful about Chung.
This has been the Bain Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as Haley H.Y. Greger interviews Joelle Presby about her latest Bain novel, Ringer. And later, we continue with part 38 of One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.